Inspirational and motivational message. First, welcome back. As the new dean of the School of Public Health, it is good to see a fellow traveler and to know that we can inspire our students and ourselves to do great things. Thank you. Four credits notwithstanding, it is obvious that you are both educated and have provided us today with a profound education and a motivating one at that. And I hasten to add that seeds are planted below ground, and perhaps Ken Warner and his colleagues thought that you needed a little time below ground in Observatory Lodge to germinate. And we're delighted in about what you've grown into. I will take the privilege of the podium and ask the first question as audience members go to one of two microphones that are in the corridor. In the aisleways, and we will alternate the microphones. But given the enormity of the problems that you so nicely outlined for us today that face us as a species, what and how should we be educating our students in the modern University of Michigan?
First of all, I was honored to give the commencement address at the School of Public Health about 3 years ago. And when I finished, Ken Warner turned to me and said, well, thanks for that. We'd like to show you the door. And I thought he was serious, and I started to leave. He said, no, I mean we'd like to give you the door. And he had actually taken the door from my office at Observatory Lodge and unhinged it. Mary, they were tearing it apart anyway, and I don't know if he charged his account, and they sent me the door to my house. It's now my front door, so I'm really, I've preserved all of it. We need a whole new generation of leaders, leaders who are cross-trained in governance, who understand risk literacy, who can communicate complex problems in simple ways, who truly believe in democracy, and who are willing to engage with their constituents in a way that ups the conversation so people know what the hell they're voting for and what the consequences and the risks that they're taking on. We've reached the stage where the public is being used as if it were the ultimate reinsurer. What happens when a nuclear power plant is built on an earthquake fault and things go bad? It's paid for by the taxpayers in ways that we haven't contemplated. Who has done the risk-cost-benefit analysis of continuing to use fossil fuels? So these are not things that we normally train students with. It's a shame, but I think that the three R's of reading, writing, and arithmetic must have a fourth R added: risk, as we understand the ever more risky world that we have inherited and the complex interrelatedness of the factors that lead to it.
Thank you. I read a book on the eradication of smallpox by Dr. D.A. Henderson, who happened to be my father's college roommate at Oberlin College.
And a very wonderful man. 80 years old this week, I think.
And that's my dad's age. So it's my understanding that a small pick that looks like a crescent wrench was used to lower the cost of administering a dose of smallpox vaccine. And that because of the low cost, it was then a functional program. So my question to you is, how do we do these projects on the cheap?
I think your question is, how do you get really great technology and then use declining costs per unit made, the magic of large numbers, to drive it into the field. So we call that a bifurcated needle. It was a sewing needle that a fellow named Rubin had taken and pounded to make the distal end of it flat and had a little hole, a little slit in it that held a meniscus of fluid that had exactly the right inoculum of the vaccine. The vaccine was produced so that that size meniscus held the right inoculum for a single vaccination. And because the smallpox vaccination was given here, you could train villagers who couldn't read, couldn't write, didn't have any other job to vaccinate. So you could turn the entire population into vaccinators. Instead of using these powerful vaccination jet guns that would cost tens of thousands of dollars, require electricity, which you didn't have. That innovation was one of the five or six great innovations that made it possible to eradicate smallpox. Another one was the observation by Bill Fagy when he was a missionary in Nigeria during the Igbo-Nigerian Civil War. He ran out of vaccine. It's a little bit like the Hanukkah story, running out of oil. He ran out of vaccine, and he thought morally he could only send the vaccine to the places that had the disease. It makes a lot of intuitive sense now, but that's not the way it used to be done. You used to vaccinate everybody, but it doesn't help an outbreak of smallpox in Detroit to vaccinate people in Los Angeles. So Bill started sending vaccine only to the places that had the disease. That led to a whole new way of epidemiology called surveillance and containment. Those two are probably the two big innovations. And the great genius of Bill Fagy and D.A. Henderson is that not only were they scientists who could see those innovations, but they were operational, and they knew how to bring them into the program and diffuse them and communicate their value. And I think that's the real trick. We're finding equally great innovations in the fight against guinea worm, which is a terrible disease. It's the biblical name for it is dracunculiasis, the fiery serpent. And the Carter Center is leading the charge on that. And the innovation that they use is nothing more than an oil cloth, a filtration system where the holes are large enough for water to go through and too small for the snail incubated parasite to go through. Simple as that, and it's cut the prevalence from 30 million down to about 6,000, and it's on its way out. So if you have a mindset to conquering a disease, to conquering one of these great threats, your mind is prepared for the discovery and the diffusion of those innovations without which you could not succeed. So great example. Love to DA.
While you're speaking about strategies that revolutionized addressing some of these problems, how do you think we can solve most of the problems you addressed within a capitalist system?
So capitalism is probably the most misused word next to patriotism. I mean, when we talk about capitalism, if it means the free market economy that allows entrepreneurs to take risk capital, not micro debt, but credit, and turn it into jobs and to create employment and create opportunities, it's one of the most beautiful things in the world. And not only could we conquer these threats without it, we cannot conquer them without that kind of an engine of change. But capitalism has become a shibboleth, like communism was in the McCarthy commissions, where if somebody doesn't like giving you the freedom to pollute, do unconscionable acts, exploit people, you're labeled anti-capitalist. That kind of capitalism isn't going to help us to stop global threats. It is a global threat. And in fact, if you think about it, what is it about the Supreme Court decision that allows large corporations to be able to spend their money influencing votes, but they can't go to jail when they screw up? What is it about that that's capitalism? That's not capitalism. We have created a mythology about capitalism where those who hate it attribute all of society's ills to it, and those who benefit from it attributed all of the great things that we've done in this country to it. So the first thing I would say is it's time to bring back the public intellectuals. I'd love to hear that debate between Gore Vidal and Bill Buckley about what is the meaning of capitalism. I'd love to rediscover what it is about the engine of the free market that we all adore and what it is about the trappings that we all feel are holding us back. And I just don't think we're going to have that conversation unless we ask for it loud and clear. But we need that conversation very much.
Thank you. Hi, Larry. Howard Hu from the School of Public Health.
Hey, Howard. How are you?
Good. Thank you. A few years ago, I got a call from the pastor of a church in Ann Arbor, and the pastor is the leader of the local chapter of evangelicals.
Ken Anderson?
Against climate change, right.
Is it Ken?
Yes.
Ah.
And
we went to the Arctic together.
Is that right?
He's a wonderful guy. He's not here by any chance.
No.
I was just talking about him about an hour ago.
He asked me to organize an event, which I did with some intrepid faculty from the School of Natural Resources, Business, the School of Public Health, to have a conversation with these pastors of megachurches in the Midwest area to talk about climate change. And even though everybody was really friendly and we started off with really nice sort of reviews of what is known, it quickly became clear that some of the suspicion about the climate change science harkened all the way back to the debate about evolution and what is really science and what's the interface between science and religion. And it's the kind of tension that's seems so different from you sitting in front of Martin Luther King and enjoying the religion and the community's interest in investing in human rights and social change. We seem to be losing the battle of opinion on that level in terms of what really is science and what is science's role. Can you address that?
Well, first, you found one of the best people around. And I would say that one of the things that gives me the most optimism is to see what we used to call right-wing evangelicals who are on fire about social justice and climate change and against nuclear proliferation, and to have great conversations and have common cause. I find that to be the common cause and those great discussions to be increasing, not decreasing. But you have to step back a second. You know, in politics, they talk about driving up somebody's negatives. And Nancy Pelosi is sort of like the poster child. She had $100 million in negative publicity aimed at her to drive up her negatives, and they drove up her negatives. I think the only thing that's had more money spent to drive up its negatives is science, and particularly climate science. And I say this without any anger or blame, but if you were the CEO of Exxon and you had a $300 billion market cap and you went to the board and you said, wait a minute, there's some disturbing science findings that people shouldn't be buying my product anymore. The CEO's fiduciary duty is not to find a way to help the protesters or the scientists. This is the bad part of capitalism. In fact, if you're interested, there's a remarkable theorist on capitalism, Roger Martin, who publishes a blog at the Harvard Business Review. His argument is that until 1978, most American capitalism was driven by the words that are chiseled on the marble of Procter & Gamble. And it's their mission statement, which is, customers first, employees second, communities third, shareholders fourth. And if you take care of the first three, the fourth will take care of itself. And he argues that that got turned around. And when it got turned around, then the incentive for companies that would lose market share to attack the derivative conveyors of that news became greater. So I would say, how can you blame people who have seen so much of an attack on science for thinking that it was suspect? And our job is to join the fray and to get good at the conversation. And it's particularly important in climate. You don't need to be a rocket scientist or an epidemiologist to know when a pandemic is coming, it's a bad thing, right? And people dying, it's pretty clear. If you're dealing with drought, and there's no water, you don't need to be a hydrologist to know that's a bad thing. If there's conflict in the Middle East, you can see it. If there's a nuclear bomb exploded in anger, you know about it. But climate is different. We're dealing with an odorless, tasteless, colorless, invisible gas that some kind of oracle and seers are telling us in 20 years is going to destroy the world. It defies common sense. The urgency for climate change arises from the science, unlike the other threats that we deal with. Therefore, that science, once attacked, allows the attackers to unravel all the arguments about science. That's why it's so critical that we all be held accountable to what we say about the science, particularly climate, but everything else, what our sources are and the transparency, and when we make mistakes, own our mistakes. And the scientists have made some mistakes. The IPCC made a mistake. It said that the Himalayan glaciers are going to melt in 30 years when probably it's closer to 100 years or whatever that number might be. Now, in historical time, that's not a very big difference, and we need those glaciers. But it allowed for an accurate criticism of that exaggeration to become a toehold of the attack on the IPCC. I don't deny we have a big problem in the attack on science. I just don't think it's the right-wing evangelicals that are the problem. I think their heart's in the right place. I think we need to make the case better, and we need to form a common bond with everyone whose primary purpose is the stewardship of the world.
Hello, my name is Joanna Coteau. I'm retired and grateful to this gentleman who yielded his place to me. Chivalry is not dead, and there's hope for the future generation. Thank you. I wanted to go back to the first question made by the Vice President. How can we educate our students? And I wondered if you could comment further on this. It seems to me that with the daily making of news by all of us, a lot of news need close scrutiny, need analysis, need critical thinking. And yesterday, I was privileged to a conversation with a person from Iowa, I'm from Iowa, who was delighted that we, the people, showed them and we defeated those judges. And when I told her what the issue was all about and how billions of dollars were poured in by corporation to defeat judges for marriage equality, she totally could not believe me. She said, how could I have been duped like this? And that's what I'm trying to say. Our education has got to be better in critical thinking. And I wonder what you could say about that.
I just had a couple of hours with Rosina listening to some of the initiatives at several of the institutions that were co-sponsoring this talk. And I was so pleased to see the emphasis on cross-disciplinary studies, on critical thinking, on ways to find commonalities between problems of water and the environment. It was very refreshing. I think that things are well on their way. I just don't think it's as easy as it used to be. Problems and sciences mature at different rates. I could go back to medical school today and still pass an anatomy exam. That's the only exam I could pass today. Nothing's changed much in anatomy. Maybe there's a blood vessel here or a nerve there that's been discovered. But, I look at the changes that have taken place in genomics and in all the new biotech. I'm useless. Every year when it comes time to renew my license, I wonder if it's ethical for me to still practice medicine because I don't know anything. But the problems have moved at a different pace. The education that I had for Latin and Greek are still pretty good, but that's not true for the other things that I learned. The new world is a world of incredible complexity because of globalization, because of discovery, because of technology, because we're better and smarter. Young people can parallel process and have devices that feed in information at a rate that we've never experienced, and young brains are malleable enough to increase the number of synaptic junctions and deal with that. We need to find a way to include in that curriculum good judgment, an understanding of risk, good values, an understanding that we're all in this together, and an appreciation for the world around us. I am still somewhat taken aback that 80% today of our new congressmen didn't have passports, had never traveled outside of the United States. That may not have been a course at their university, but it doesn't sound to me like a full education if the extent of your travel is to Toledo, Ohio. That just, great museum, but it's not enough.
We'll reward chivalry. Yes.
Thank you. Seriously, though, thank you for all the good things that you've done. I didn't know you existed an hour and a half ago, and I'm quite impressed.
I still have my doubts. You'd have to show me the proof.
So my question is maybe a little bit selfish, but how do I get where you are? And
it's only about 30 yards.
Maybe more specifically, though, as a doctorate student in a research department that rewards research that's an inch wide and a mile deep, I don't feel like I'm going to be able to get the breadth of knowledge I need to do something like you're doing. Because to make a big difference, you can't just know a lot about one thing, right? And also, I'm young and I have time to learn, but time's running out, like you said earlier. So how do the career paths for myself and my colleagues differ from the way they were in the 60s and 70s? And how do we get what you've done before it's too late?
I don't really think it's a question about me. I think that we have some pretty conventional notions of what a career is. You ought to just abandon those. The advice I used to give to people who ask questions like that was to think that you'll have five careers and to plan a life accordingly and to realize that numbers 3, 4, and 5 are a hell of a lot easier than 1 and 2 because you've already learned how to learn new stuff. You've already learned how to be a stranger in your first class. You've already learned how to use synthetic thinking to solve some of the problems. But that implies a career which is sequential. And I don't think you even need to do that anymore. I think we're entering an era where it's not just Intel that makes parallel processing. I think you've got a parallel processor. And that you're able to parallel process many more things. The great Zen Buddhist Suzuki Roshi used to say that the greatest mind was the beginner's mind, and that to master a new subject, approach everything with a beginner's mind. And I think that's more true today than ever before. I would just say approach everything all at once in every direction with that beginner's mind.
I would ask, in the interest of time, that we not add to the lines for questioning. Okay. Question over here.
Thank you for a wonderful talk.
Thank you.
I teach in the College of Architecture and Urban Planning, and as you know, the world is rapidly urbanizing. It was predominantly rural until recently. It's 50% urban now. It's soon to be 2/3, maybe 3/4. And although cities have big ecological footprints, big carbon footprints, actually, on a per capita basis, they have a smaller one than...
I'm sorry, would you repeat that? What was?
Cities, although they have a big ecological footprint, actually have a smaller one per capita.
Per capita, right. Mm-hmm.
So in a way, it's good news. It's a good trend. But there's some negative externalities we know, like increased crime and arguably increased disease. And I'm just wondering, this is a question I got from a student today, actually. How would you balance the negative health, public health consequences and impacts of rapid urbanization versus the positive environmental ones? Do you see it as a net win, or do you see it as a problematized trade-off? Urbanization versus increased communicable and other disease spread.
I see it as a net win to have more people living in urban areas. I'm sorry about that. I'm sorry because it's not always as much fun. And it's not as green. But it's true that we have a smaller carbon footprint per capita when we live in urban areas. It's also true that the ways that we can solve problems are quicker. Steve Chu, the wonderful energy secretary, says that he would be thrilled if we could but paint all of our housetops white, because the change in a dark roof absorbing and a white roof reflecting, this is a particular passion of his, as you guys know, would make such a big difference for such a small unit cost. Well, you just can't do that if you're spread out over 100 million acres of land. You can do that if you're in 20 big cities. I've often dreamed of, you know, kind of rethinking green cities, emerald cities, sometimes they're called, by looking at solar thermal and using the rooftops to hold the massive mirror arrays and focus those arrays on a column of either molten sodium or water, but put that in the middle of a city as if it were a building on its own, because you don't have to change the power grid. The single biggest problem we have for renewable energy is that you don't get it 24 hours a day. It's not load-based, and we don't have a grid where we can move it. If we could miniaturize it and put it in cities, the grid's already there. A great book to read are the two books that Stuart Brandt wrote, one on urbanization and one called The Environmental Discipline, on the value that urbanization brings to fighting climate change. You know, we have all sorts of other issues, though, that we're not talking about. If we just say disease and climate change, I say cities. I don't know, we were talking about water today. Is it 60 or 70 or 75% of the water in the world that's used to grow food, and that's mostly rural, but the way in which you can get the most immediate gain from water is to fix the urban water systems, which are so leaky that we're losing 40 or 50% of all the water. I think Manila loses, I'm sure somebody here knows, but I think it's a world record of 55% of all the water that is produced in Manila is leaked out through its terribly leaky urban water system. So you're producing double the amount of water per capita that you would need to if you fix those systems. Rural and urban, agricultural and consumer, they all have their own set of issues. But I think the trend is towards these urban megacities. Japan, Tokyo is, what, 30 million now? I forgot the number, but something like that. I think that to not try to roll with that trend would probably be futile and a mistake intellectually. I think we have to be able to fix the problems of urban living because we've inherited it. And since July 2009, when we passed 50% of people living in urban areas, that hasn't changed. I'm sure you all know that the greatest internal migration in human history has been in China, from the rural communities in the center of China to the urban cities along the coast. And as much as the Chinese government tries to slow that down, I'm not sure they'll be successful. City means opportunity in so many different languages.
Dr. Brilliant, I want to just thank you for the contributions you've made to relieve human suffering throughout the world. And it's just really inspiring to see you here. Thank you for coming. What technological advances do you see happening in energy in the next 20, 25 years or so that may improve energy sustainability?
Well, on May 1st, I get my plug-in Prius. They're only giving it to me for 2 months to play with. I mean, to experiment with. I think that it's pretty amazing. I videotaped and I've kept on my TiVo system, Who Killed the Electric Car, which is, of course, an attack on General Motors, which is the trivia answer to Who Killed the Electric Car is General Motors. And now to see them come out with the Chevy Volt, which is probably one of the most breathtaking pieces of technology you can ever see. It's the right way to make an electric car, because the small gas engine is used not to propel the car, but only to charge the batteries from which the electric motor works. I'm thrilled to see the advances in Tesla, another great electric car company. I'm thrilled to see the scramble for hybrid cars. I think that's low-hanging fruit. Now let's look at the situation that we have in power plants. It is true that if you have 1 million plug-in cars, plug-in hybrids, and you plug them in a million houses at night with a tiny little bit of a smart meter, so you're buying low when your electrical costs are low, and you're then selling that back to the grid by keeping it plugged in during peak demand, when everybody turns on an air conditioner in the summer or office lights at the start of work, 1 million electric cars, you can provide as much electricity as most middle-sized American cities need. That's pretty damn cool. The trick is, it's not the electric car that's doing it. It is the battery. So let me skip the middleman. Go one direction with our electric cars. Why don't we just build big batteries, huge batteries? The CEO of Duke Energy was faced with the decision whether to build a new nuclear plant, $1 billion, or 100,000 rooftop, 100,000 solar rooftop photovoltaics. And he chose to do the photovoltaics because he could use them to put power right back into the neighborhood, the same places where he's putting the photovoltaics. He said he would do that for 100% of his power production, close his coal-fired electrical plants and no more nuclear if he had batteries big enough to back up all of the renewable energy providers and back up 50% of his coal-fired utilities. I think unless we're going to have a smart grid that stretches across the country, allows us to do load shedding and power shedding and be extremely vulnerable to terrorism, which it would be, The major technological opportunity now is huge batteries. Batteries that can store a gigawatt of energy. We do that, and we're a long way towards getting off of fossil fuels, both coal and oil at the same time. And Michigan's the best place in the world to do that. We're starting to get really good in battery technology for cars. This is the same thing, just a little bit bigger.
Well, first, thank you for inspiring the next generation of social activists. I was thrilled that you mentioned the challenges of addressing risk. I'm the director of the Risk Science Center here, so it was directly in line with what
Annie,
I'm trying
to achieve.
Annie,
where are you? Grab him afterwards.
But looking at the issue of risk, it's very clear that we've got to develop new approaches of addressing risks which are evidence-based yet socially responsive. And very clearly, we can do this over time by educating the next generation of graduates and students coming through this and other universities. But as you mentioned, time is of the essence. So how do we go about changing the risk dialogue that's happening here and now out in society with major issues?
I don't know. I mean, I'm on the Global Agenda Council on Risk for the World Economic Forum. And when we meet, the issue number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is how do you get people to think in terms of risks? And ironically, the only people who have a practice of it outside of academicians, that at least that I've been able to find, tell me if I'm wrong, I'm not talking about op research or policy analysis or complex modeling, but I'm talking about risk as an occupation, are the reinsurance companies, Swiss Re, Munich Re. They're damn rich. They're really successful because they can do an arbitrage. They know what the real risk is, that you're going to die, that you're going to get sick, that your city's going to blow up, that a nuclear power plant is going to explode, that a ship is going to not make its destination, and they charge you 3 times that. It's like stealing. If there was some way that we could convince people that you level the playing field by being able to gather the same information, which is publicly available almost always. And to some extent, that knowledge that risk information was publicly available is one of the things that created the boom in hedge funds. Because what hedge fund operators did was they went out and hired the smartest risk analysts from the reinsurance companies. When they were at the reinsurance company, they were being paid a salary. When they were brought into the hedge funds, they shared the risk and they shared the returns. So somehow we need to make it more sexy. We need to make it more lucrative. Risk sounds pretty boring and always negative. When you say risk, you and I are talking about probabilistic risk. We're talking about Gaussian distribution. We're talking about, you know, the kind of mathematics that are neutral to a positive or negative event. When everybody else hears the word risk, they hear, God, it's a huge risk that I'm not going to make it home tonight. We've got to change that somehow if we want to change the conversation. And I just don't know how to do that. I'd love your advice. I think you're the only risk professional in the room. Maybe you can tell us. Thank you. We'll take you both.
In the interest of time, could I ask, with apologies to the last questioners, can I ask you to state your question briefly and then allow Dr. Brilliant to address all three of them? First on the left.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much for your talk and for your work. My question comes back to the earlier question about capitalism and to pick up on what you said about the public good versus privately held goods. And now I'm thinking about public risk and privatized profit. And I'm wondering if you might speak to the possibility of, What should the responsibilities be of a publicly held company? I'm interested in the corporate charter movement and being able to hold corporations accountable for the privileges of being publicly traded. And I was wondering if you could address that.
I'm actually going to respond to that directly if I can. Do you know Ceres? Do you know the work of Ceres?
No.
So they're an NGO that... works on forcing, persuading, lobbying the SEC to require, as a condition of being public, corporations to disclose the risks that they face as a consequence of climate change. So, normally a corporation in its S-1 would have to file what the risks are that it'll go bankrupt. And in its quarterly statements, its 10 Qs, it would have to file what's the risk that their CEO is going to leave or that this market is going to be abandoned or this country's not going to give them a license. Now they also have to file what's the risk that their dependence on oil or coal will have an unexpected negative cost, either because of regulatory action or supply chain interruption or because of climate change. I think that's the way to address public corporations is through their filings and through disclosure. Because as an investor, when a pension fund reads the 10Q or the 10K and they see that kind of risk, they're going to stay away from the company. So the company is going to do everything it can then to reduce that risk, which they otherwise would not have an incentive to do just from good stewardship alone.
Hello, my name's Aviva Schwader and I'm from Saline High School. In coming from a student's perspective, I have a vested interest in becoming more aware of the world and everything that goes on. And to make myself more aware, I participate in Model UN and try to read the New York Times every day, but I was wondering what you suggest to help the new generation become more educated and more globalistic.
Well, first, thank you for coming, and I really appreciate your forthrightness, and you've learned exactly how to speak, and it was really spectacular just listening to you. Could you do it again, please?
Thank you.
get as much data from as many opposing views as you possibly can. Read the monthly Monday report from the National Council of Evangelicals and the weekly review from Al Jazeera. Read as many different opposing views as you possibly can. Mainstream media is doing that. That's how they get their information, is from these sort of offbeat, opposing kinds of sources of information. You can get all this now on a BlackBerry or on your computer or on your handheld device. And for the first time ever, these huge differing opinions can be delivered into your mailbox every day. You're way ahead of where anybody else in this room was at your age. You're probably way ahead of where everybody in this room is today. Thank you.
Just stepping off that just a little bit right here, of course, Aviva did a wonderful, fabulous job on everything. Since I'm also a Celine High School student, we came here together with our friend Sarah over there. And so working off that, and so, like, you know, you're talking about the new generation and these fresh, moldable minds that can push the limits of possibility and everything. So getting knowledge, like being aware and looking at opposing viewpoints is like the first step, I obviously, but how do we become part of this movement, and how do we become really cool like you?
Can I give you my daughter's email? Would you write to her? Yeah, I assure you, cool and me have never been in the same sentence with my daughter. Well, you're already part of the movement. You can't escape it. Your age, your proximity to the University of Michigan, the fact that you're here, the questions that you've asked, you've lit your lamp and you can't keep it under a bushel anymore. From now on, all these ideas and people are yours to ask and question and make themselves available to you. There's something Margaret Mead once said, never doubt the power of a small group of people to change the world. It has always been thus. It will ever be thus. This is a moment in history when, if we succeed, when we succeed, when having succeeded we look back, we will say to ourselves, thank God we gathered together, we asked ourselves the same questions, we prodded ourselves to more actions, we forced ourselves to come to more sophisticated conclusions, and we surrounded ourselves with people smarter than us who could tell us what to do. And you're one of those people for me, so thank you very much for coming.
Take the opportunity to meet and greet Dr.